on April 29th of 2013 is about public education. Gary Hunt is the guest, and your host is Sleepy Salsa. And that was Ashley Alisize's A Dangerous Situation. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You are listening to Outpost of Freedom Radio. An understanding of contemporary government schools reveals a widespread loathing by today's young people against the hegemonic control of curriculum, hypocritical authority figures, and American society itself. Where did this come from? Is it because of the natural rebelliousness of youth? Or is there something more sinister afoot, deliberately tearing the next generation away from their heritage? What are their teachers doing with them during most of their waking hours anyway? Education or indoctrination? How destructive has public schooling been to American civilization? With that said, let us turn to our guest. Gary, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Good evening, Sleepy.
Good evening. Gary, what is the history of public education in America?
The history of public education in America, we need to really, to understand it, put it in proper perspective, you need to understand how people perceive public education today. And that's best defined as government schools, because it has become government schools. But when we go back in our history, we go back to the early colonial times, there were public schools along Chesapeake Bay area, for example. They bought the services of the school teacher with codfish, and just like they traded in tobacco, they traded in codfish, and then the instructor, the teacher, would sell the codfish if he needed, or trade it for chickens or whatever he wanted. But Jefferson, of the founders, the most interested in public education. And after the Constitution, in the early 1800s, we had a proliferation of educational facilities set up, especially in the North, not so much in the South because of distances between plantations, but they used tutors in the South. But in the northern states, they tended to have common schools, free schools, various types of schools. Some were run by charity. Some were paid for. The common schools in towns were paid for by the community. There were free schools for Negro children. There were free schools even for women or girls. So the concept of public education did kick off, and there was a recognition that educated people are much more capable of making decisions regarding government, their life, and everything else. Sanitation improved. All kinds of benefits came out of this. And it wasn't until, say, the late 1800s when public schools became very common. There's a online, there's Elements of Civil Government, and in that, in chapters chapter two, talks about how the structure of public schools, school districts, in about 1890, most people recognized that probably one of the most productive and useful education systems in the world existed in the United States in that period, all the way till about 1930, when public schools began to change their nature in this country. So the history is long. It's as long as the country itself. And it, like the country, prospered and developed methods of teaching. And as the country developed methods of production that exceeded anything else in the world. But then somewhere after the Civil War, we began to see declines in, well, by the 1900s, began to see decline in both the productivity of America and the educational system. They were slow, but they were there.
Does religion have a place in public schools?
Well, it definitely did. And if we're concerned with a culture, which is necessary for a nation to have an identity, and if we're desirous of having a common morality, then I think definitely education should incorporate religious studies to some degree, not intense, but as far as moral values. Now, going back through that history again, there was a book that was existed in almost every home back at the time, and there was no textbook back then or anything else. There were McGuffey readers and various publications that assisted in learning how to read, but primarily the Bible was used even in the schools, especially the smaller schools, as the only means of learning how to read. It was not a contradiction to the separation of church and state, which is not in the Constitution, but in a letter that Jefferson wrote. And it was used to some extent all the way through the 1930s and then continued on after that, slowly being determined to be unconstitutional, a violation of separation of church and state. Now, interestingly, that coincided with the state becoming the controller of the schools, because prior to that, the public schools belonged to the people that supported and utilized the school, and they weren't the government, so there was no separation between the public and religion. So it was the takeover by government that was instrumental, really, in removing the religious studies from education.
How were public schools funded?
Well, as I mentioned, in Cape Cod, the codfish or fish were actually used in payment. In Virginia, a lot of tutors were paid with tobacco. But when we started getting into the Jeffersonian concept and what I was talking about, the common schools, the free schools were generally run by charitable organizations that received in months or contributions from people in the community, and that paid the fare for the school. The common schools tended to be the ones in communities large enough where the community felt that the need was there and began this concept of a school district and a public school in the sense that it's a free public school and it's funded by the community. The concept that evolved and grew to its greatness through the 1930s. The funding then, though, was mandatory tax, and for the most part, the research that I've done, ad valorem taxes, the taxes on your property, the only place that it went was, at least on private ownership, was to the school system. So if you had land, you paid taxes on it, that went directly to the school district and was the source of funding. And that millage then was based on the demand for the cost of the school versus the amount of land available to tax. The concept has changed since then because the ad valorem taxes now pay welfare people and the federal government funds the schools primarily.
What did Thomas Jefferson mean by public education?
Well, I don't think in what I've read from Jefferson, I don't think he was as farsighted as to see what we have now. But he talked about a system whereby everybody would receive a few years of education. Those that excelled would go higher, and those that excelled beyond that would go to the University of Virginia. But he saw the necessity for education at all levels. But as I said, those that excelled went up, and those that excelled in the next level went up to the university or college level, unlike today where anybody who can get a grant can go to college and kind of waste the education when they go push a broom for a living. But his idea, and he understood, as many of the founders did, that with an educated population, well, let's go back. They realized that when you keep people in subservient conditions, uneducated, it's easy to control them. The concept of republicanism, which is participatory government by all the members of the community, or at least those qualified white males and to some extent white females, but generally not Negroes at the time, that the community thrives when people are educated. They can communicate, they can contract, they can understand what they're doing, they can learn, they can see what's happening in government. So all in all, we're going to have a much more comfortable Republican form of government if we have education. So his concept was to provide free education, but it was based on the qualifications because of the necessity for having literate populations, educated populations, people that could count and do mathematics. And I think that's proven to be true. The people that criticize public education today fail to recognize that their ability to type out the criticisms of public education are based upon the fact that they had a public education to learn how to type out their criticisms of it.
Why should anyone care about public education?
Well, same reason the founders did. There's no reason not to think of it in light of if we have uneducated or illiterate people, they become the peons. They become the bottom of and they've got no future. So they become alcoholics, they become criminals, and things like that. The idea is to not make everybody equal, but provide opportunity for everybody. But how can you have opportunity if you can't read, write, reading, writing, arithmetic? We should all care because the greatness of America grew from that public education, and it proved itself over that first century and a half almost in what became the greatest nation the world had ever known, which has since gone into a state of decline. So our caring for our country, for our community, for our state, for the city, for everything that we care about, education is foundational and fundamental to achieving what we expect or would like to see in those areas of our lives.
Should public education be mandatory?
Education should be mandatory. Public education, no. I mean, we've always had private schools. We've always had tutors. And basically, homeschooling is tutors. The parents are the tutors. Education should be mandatory, though. Now, should government judge the quality of a private school education or the tutors educating the child or the parents educating the child? No, so long as they learn the basics, reading, writing, arithmetic, and a few others, and we'll talk about that later, as long as they get a degree of education. It should be mandatory. But to say public schools, where it's done in the public schools, it should be mandatory, and if you don't have the alternative, then public school becomes the remedy. Now, again, we have to understand public school in a proper context, and that's not the one that most of us were raised with and understand to be public education today, which is better defined as government schools.
Are private schools and homeschooling superior to public education?
Potentially, yes, because when you get a larger group of people, there's some necessity of teaching down. Many years ago when I was a hippie and my father was president of Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University, we were talking about education, and I said, boy, I could afford to go to Bethune-Cookman's. It's a black university in Daytona Beach. And he said, you don't want to go there. You won't get an education there. I said, what do you mean? He said, they have to teach down to the students that attend Bethune-Cookman, and their background is not conducive to a higher education. That's very true. You have to look at the quality of education. Now, if you have a good tutor, you potentially can have a much greater advancement. I'm going to give another example. When I was in the Palos Verdes School District, when I was a kid, I had algebra in the sixth grade. When I got it in the ninth grade in the Los Angeles School District, because we didn't have a junior high school in Palos Verdes, I had to take algebra again 3 years later. When you have a better class of students, you can progress further. If you have a tutor or you're homeschooled, you can progress at your pace. When you're dealing with a larger public education system, you're dealing with reducing that pace. I'm not talking about no student left behind. I mean, some people just are incapable. But so potentially you've got the ability to have a much higher quality of education in homeschooling and private schools, where they're more directed at and tend to get a different class of, or, you know, foundational quality student. Let me throw on one more thing. An interesting concept in the West, where there were few students and they varied greatly in age. The concept in the schoolhouse tended to be that you taught everybody as rapidly as you could. However, the more learned students then became instructors for the lower levels. And they were interesting concepts, and you know, the whole entire Midwest developed on this concept that these students were carried along as fast as they possibly could be, because they were judged on their ability, and then they moved up and became instructors. And there's nothing better for a student to also be an instructor, because he knows how to teach as well as to learn.
Are grades and report cards important?
I think in anything you do, there needs to be some recognition of achievement. You know, that's what we thrive on. You know, thank you, that was a good job. It makes anybody feel good about what they did. And so report cards, yes, I think are absolutely necessary to show the amount of achievement that's been accomplished. The unfortunate part of that, though, has come more recently in the government school system. I was certified in the state of Florida to teach surveying in junior college and college level, because I was a registered surveyor and passed a sample examination and paid the $25 or $35, whatever it was. Now, I taught at Valencia Community College surveying for one semester. At the end of the semester, I was handed a stack of papers, and they were to hand out to my students, and they were called Student Evaluation of Instructor. Needless to say, that was the last time I taught surveying in any school system, because the idea is not to judge the instructor, it's to judge what you have learned. And if you've got the book, you can learn. But when you start judging the instructor, you're trying to encourage him to get a good grade, which means he might give you a good grade more than what you deserve, so that he gets a good grade. Now, if you can understand that that circle, that cycle doesn't work, in fact, that same aspect, this evaluation of the instructors, this lady that got indicted a while back for teaching her students and giving the answers for the evaluation, the STEM evaluation tests, she was getting bonuses because she got good grades. You can't turn it around. It has to be the instructor is the leader. He's the teacher, and that's it. And the evaluation of the instructor can and should only be done by the school district. If all the kids come out dumb, you fire the damn teacher. That's it. So, yes, they're important if they're properly administered, if they become part of a theoretical cycle of improving education, which degenerates education. No, at that point, they become probably more detrimental than anything else, because the effort of the student becomes to get a good grade only, not to learn, and he does that by evaluating the instructor.
Is the government involved in how public and how local public schools are run?
Let's look at that a different way. Let's rephrase that. Is local government involved in how local public schools are run? That's easier to answer. The answer is absolutely not. About all they do now is decide who they're going to buy the government-approved textbooks from, who they're going to buy the furniture for the classrooms from, who they're going to contract to build the new school with federal funds, and things like that. It should be exclusive completely of any government involvement beyond the school district. No county involvement, no state involvement, no federal involvement like it was when it prospered in this country. When you start going up the ladder and getting government involved in public education, you have made it government education because they dictate curriculum. They'll appease you and make you think they're doing a good job. But the degeneration of the public school system in this country began with the states getting involved with funding schools. And finally, the federal government, health education, the Department of Education was formed, I think, in 1953. And that was the drawing of the executioner's blade to decent public education in this country. So absolutely not. It should all be local school district, actually, not even the government, not the city, not the county, but the school district itself. And the purpose of those people elected to the school board are elected specifically because of their concern. Their campaign is based on their concern for the education of the children.
All right, let's take a look at some current conditions. Gary, do teachers teach students how to think or what to think?
I think they taught them how to think in the past. I think now they taught them what to think. But probably more importantly is the third side of that. Did they teach them how to learn? Because learning is an art in itself. If you just sit there and listen to what comes in, do your take this quiz, write this, you're missing something there, and it's called learning how to learn. Learning how to learn is picking up a book, reading it, and gaining knowledge from it, which is the concept behind school. Now, how to think, is important to that, because you've got to, look at different areas, mathematics, science, literature, all the variety, and look at how to think about each one of those. But what to think is what they're teaching now. What to think? How do you pass that test so I can get my bonus at the end of the year? What to think should be left out completely. An example of that, when I was a student at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University, I had an English class, Dr. Nelson. I'll never forget her. She was a character. She had us read Hemingway and then had us write a short story. She gave me a D on the short story because I used fragmented sentences and improper structure and all that. And so I went to her office and I said, Dr. Nelson, you just had us read Hemingway and then you told us to write a short story. Would you have given him a D as well? So she changed my grade to a B. Now, I learned how to think, and I thought like Hemingway did because we had just gone through Hemingway. So how to think and how to learn are the important parts of school, not what to think. Absolutely not.
Why is evolution taught alongside creationism?
Evolution is a theory. Creationism is a theory, I suppose, but it's this theory that's been accepted by mankind for 2,000 years, and it was growing proportionally through that entire period. It's an accepted doctrine that relies on a single element of faith, where evolution, Darwin's theory, relies on numerous leaps of faith to jump from monkey to the next step, to the next step, to the next step. I don't think evolution, quite frankly, belongs in school except as an extracurricular activity for people that want to pursue science, anthropology, or something like that. For the average student, the moral foundation of this country is based on Christian values, and those Christian values are based on the concept of creationism or intelligent design, if we use the politically correct term. If anything, if they are going to teach evolution, they should at least play it alongside creationism. But from what I've seen, apparently some schools cannot even mention creationism or even intelligent design, the politically correct form, though evolution is mandatory, and so people think that they came from apes. And I just have trouble with that still. But I'm old school.
Yeah, and to expound upon that a little bit, I mean, back when I was in college, I took an introductory to anthropology course, and there was an extra credit paper I wrote, which I, of course, got an A on, that was about the differences between the out-of-Africa evolutionary theory versus the multi-regional model. And basically the thesis of that paper was that the various anthropologists and evolutionary scientists and whatever the terms are for the various others, is that they can't even agree on what they think is most likely. They're factions, and they go after each other. And there was also a, I think it was a PBS documentary type thing that was shown to us in one class period, where there was a paleontologist who literally admitted that, you know, it's not of a lack of, you know, evidence, physical evidence like fossils or whatever. It's, you know, we don't even know how to interpret the evidence we already have. And this is a college level. This was admitted in a college level course. And I think it was also in the textbook. And I think the professor admitted in the lecture as well, in addition to that one documentary. So yeah, for somebody who's like in the, you know, elementary, middle school, I would even say high school grades, I think it's really inappropriate to teach that for the very simple reason of complexity. More than anything else. I mean, I'm a scientist, and I have a problem with teaching folks who are not quite ready for that and to go through all the different leaps of, yeah, it's really way too much. So coming at it from a completely different perspective, yeah, you're right. It's not appropriate for that, for those grades.
Well, let's go back to the previous question on how to think and what to think. Evolution tells you what to think, doesn't it? It's a theory. It's unproven, as you've pointed out. Nobody can really argue the case from a solid foundation, the leaps of faith. How to think is a whole different story. So if somebody's going into anthropology to lay out this theory to them so that they, during their anthropological research, can kind of look for clues to prove or disprove it. But when we're taught what to think and teaching a theory in school is teaching people what to think. So theories themselves should be thrown out. Accepted foundations, if you want to call it a theory, creationism, call it a theory, but it's an accepted foundation. It's got 2,000 years of acceptance, and in this country, it's foundational to the culture of this country. So it's an accepted fact for all intents and purposes until it's disproven. So that's not what to think, because our principal already learns how to think in terms of Christian morality. So evolution is a what to think, and creationism is a really a how to think. Here's the moral values we have, and here's how we support them. And some people might say that's an awful fine line, and they probably think they evolved from monkeys too. But we'll go on to the next one.
Our public schools today essentially nothing different from government indoctrination centers.
They have become nothing less than indoctrination centers. They have taken out the fundamentals of education and thrown them aside, and what they call STEM, that's science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Everything else is gone. Now, I've got a book here, Methods of Teaching by John Sweet, published in 1888. And this is lists the methods of teaching various aspects of education back in the late 1800s, the same period that Elements of Civil Government, which talks about the school district, this talks about the teaching. Moral training is one of the issues, the moral values, which are fundamental. You know, otherwise we end up with this value-based education we have today. Intellectual training, perceptive faculties, the expressive faculties, and the reflective faculties. Damn. You ever hear that in modern school? Perceptive No. faculties, expressive faculties, and reflective faculties. How you visualize things, how you express yourself, and how you think. How to think, perhaps. Then they talk about corporal punishment and other areas, and they go into the management of ungraded country schools. So these were outside of the any evaluation. When they say grading, it's not the ABC grades; it's a certification type thing, which they'd gotten into in some areas by then. But then they go into principles, general principles. John Stuart Mill's, Thomas Huxley. Superintendent Eliot, oh, damn, we're getting into theories in Alexander Bain. The spelling, definitely. Nowadays, they don't teach spelling, I don't think, the way they used to, where you had to learn how to spell words properly. And I think that some schools are accepting what they call, text language. You know, as long as it looks like the right word, they're accepting it now. You don't have to be able to spell properly. The geography, composition, grammar, language, Greek and Latin were very commonly taught back then to diversify the ability to think and to understand things. Arithmetic, history of the United States, object lessons and elements of natural science, writing and drawing. So that's the curriculum back then. It was very diverse. And most of those are fallen by the wayside. Yes, they're indoctrination centers. Right now, they are directed only at qualifying the teachers as competent. To get their students to be able to pass the evaluation tests that the government puts out.
So does the federal government mandate the current curriculum then?
I would say pretty much so. I don't know how much flexibility there is in it, but I'm sure that there are things that must be taught in the curriculum and other things that cannot be taught. And let's put on top of that the certification of textbooks. Most states now, from what I understand, accept the government list of acceptable textbooks. Some states still do an evaluation on their own. I don't know what would happen, though, if they wanted a textbook that wasn't on the approved government list. But the curriculum, for the most part, maybe not absolutely mandated, but at least controlled probably to 90%.
Okay, so what has led to the disrespectful attitude in the classroom?
Well, among other things, student evaluation. Of instructor, which I understand in lower levels, they had in the 1980s, they had a concept called the pod system where four classes were in one room, students yelling. Lack of moral values, lack of ability to discipline. A neighbor of mine, when I lived in Florida, was a school teacher, and she taught down in one of the tougher schools in Orlando. And finally, she quit her job because she could not discipline the students that gave her a hard time. Now, we've probably seen a movie somewhere along the line that shows this attitude in the classroom. And this goes back into the 70s and 80s, maybe even the 60s in some area, where there's a total disregard of respect for the teacher. The teacher's there doing a job. If you have a job, if you're employed digging ditches, you better respect the foreman. By the same token, if you're getting an education, especially if it's free, you should respect the instructor. But the ability of the instructor to use corporal punishment, when I was a kid, a number of things could happen. I saw a number of people. Fortunately, I was never one that got their knuckles or their head cracked with a yardstick. Standing in the corner, sitting on a stool, facing the class, writing, I will not do that again 1,000 times on the chalkboard. Discipline was there, and it instilled a sense of discipline. Well, that's part of education. Self-discipline is as much education as knowing how to add 2 and 2. So as the government became operative in the schools, they began saying, well, it's not fair to discipline somebody. They've got a disease. I don't know how they justify that. I'm going to assume it's a disease. So you can't really punish them. The teachers end up having things thrown at them and having no recourse, and that's why Mandy quit teaching in the Orlando schools, because there was nothing she could do. All she could do was go to the principal, and the principal could do nothing. And she said, could, not would do nothing, could do nothing. So government, schools, and relations, which are requisite to getting the government with our own, have taken away any sense of teaching, self-discipline, and being allowed to discipline that's necessary for life.
Hey, Gary, are you with us? All right. It looks like we are experiencing some technical difficulties momentarily, so please bear with us. I'm sure Control Board will get Gary Hunt back on the on probably that other line. So, and in the meantime, yeah, there are a lot of misconceptions when it comes to the government schools. A lot of people really don't understand the Jeffersonian concept of it. A lot of people don't understand what even the current situation is, despite the fact that many people pretty much have to go through the government indoctrination centers. And so we're trying to kind of clear that up tonight. Oh, Gary, are you back with us?
Yes.
Fantastic. All right, please continue, sir.
Where was I when it cut out? I don't know where. I couldn't tell from this end where it cut out.
Probably attitude.
Let me just pick up. Lack of self-discipline and lack of ability to discipline subordinates, the teachers disciplining the students. If that is the education they're getting when they go into the workplace, are they going to have any respect for their foreman, their boss? No, they're going to think that the world owes them a living. They're going to talk back to their boss, and if they're all trained that way, the boss is just going to say, screw it, you know, I'm going to retire, and things go to hell. And that's generally where we're going in this country, isn't it?
Sure seems that way. Well, kind of on that note then, is more serious violence attributable to the education system?
I think by the same token, yes, because the violence used to be directional and it had to do with discipline. As I said, the teacher could discipline the students, and corporal punishment, violence, is a form of violence. But now it's gone the other way. Teachers have been beaten up in classrooms, not after school in a dark alley, but in classrooms in some cities like New York, Chicago, places like that. And so if we don't have the self-respect, the self-discipline, and the acceptance of moral values, then violence becomes a way of achievement. Now, there's another aspect of modern education that is called value-based education. It's not moral-based, it's value-based. And basically, it's, you know, if you think it's the right thing to do, then do it. And that theft, violence, anything, as long as it feels good, if it's to impress your friends, if it's to make a YouTube video showing you beating the shit out of a homeless man, that's value-based education, because you got a kick out of doing this video. It doesn't matter at all about the homeless man that you beat the shit out of. So, yeah, violence is directly attributable to the education system now, or at least I believe it is, because the degree of violence from in young people today is phenomenal. When I was a kid, it was rare, and it was swiftly punished. And now it's become a way of life, one to exalt over on YouTube.
Do teachers and principals have too much power over students?
Absolutely not anymore, as I just explained. They used to have the necessary power, and a good principal and a good teacher would extend that power or authority only to the extent necessary to maintain a decent decorum in the classroom. But no, it's been taken away. They have lost their ability, as I mentioned, Mandy and the principal. They could do nothing. Interesting article I read the other day. I didn't realize it. I went back to visit my father. I think I was in the 10th grade then, maybe 11th grade, in Miami. And I went to school there for a semester, North Miami Senior High School. That school district, the Miami Greater Miami School District, has a police department now, a real police department, arrest powers and everything. There's a guy named Trayvon Martin that had a nice, clean record. The reason he had a nice, clean record is he was caught once with burglary tools and women's jewelry in school, but they were trying to cut down the arrest rate in the school, and this guy, the head of the police department, got fired over this, the chief of police. So what they did is they suspended him rather than arresting him. He was caught with marijuana in school. They suspended him rather than arresting him. So they could honestly say he's never been arrested. He had burglary tools. He didn't go to court over it. You know, there was no trial or anything. So, but to have a police department assigned to the school district with arrest powers, but then they back off because they don't want all their students back to the grading, the evaluation of students. It wouldn't look good if too many of their students were arrested and charged with a crime, so instead they suspend them, which is what the principals used to do, but now apparently it takes a police department to suspend a student.
All right, so before we go to break then, what is the difference between Jefferson's idea of public education and the government indoctrination schools of today?
Well, Jefferson felt that the students should be educated so that they understood the basics of life, they understood math, reading, writing, and arithmetic, and I'm going to stick to that, but it would be the list that I read a little while ago from that 1888 book. The government indoctrination system of today mandates moral valuation. It eliminates education in the basic areas, back to what they call STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. There's no morality in any of that. Science has no morality to it. Technology has no morality to it. Engineering has no morality to it. And mathematics has no morality to it. Where is history? Where is language? Where is reading and understanding, the reflective, the expressive, and the three that I mentioned earlier? They're gone from this. And they would be, if that were put in front of Jefferson, he would say that that list in that book that I read is probably a good foundation for education. Whether it would all apply to the first level, remember he had three levels. The first level was everybody, or go to the second level, or might be moved up to the third level, I can't say. But those elements were there, and there was very little in science and technology and engineering and mathematics compared to the basics, or what they call general education requirements in college, which I don't know if they're the same now as they were when I went to college.
All right, everybody. We will be taking questions after the break. Our call-in number is area code 530-576-5790. Again, that is 530-576-5790. Alternatively, you can add user OPF radio to your Skype contacts list, and if we bring you on that way, please mute your mic until we mention for you. Or you can simply type your question to the listener chat room, and I will read them for you on the air. So while we wait for those lovely questions to hopefully come in during the break, go ahead, lie back, sit back, grab a cup of coffee, do whatever you need to do, and we will return momentarily.
The British are coming! The British are coming!
Now the ride of Paul Revere set the nation on its ear, and the shot at Lexington heard round the world. When the British fired in the early dawn, the War of Independence had begun. The die was cast, the rebel flag unfurled, and on to Concord marched the foe to seize the arsenal there, you know, waking folks searching all around. Till our militia stopped them in their tracks. At the old North Bridge, we turned them back and chased those redcoats back to Boston town. And the shout heard round the world was the start of the revolution. The men were ready on the move. Take your powder, take your gun, report to General Washington. Hurry, men, there's not an hour to lose. Now at famous Bunker Hill, even though we lost, it was quite a thrill. The rebel Colonel Prescott proved he was wise. Outnumbered and low on ammunition, as the British stormed his position, he said, hold your fire till you see the whites of their eyes. Though the next few years were rough, General Washington's men proved they were tough. Those hungry, ragged boys would not be beat. One night they crossed the Delaware, surprised the Hessians in their lair, and at Valley Forge they just bundled up their feet. Now the shot heard round the world was the start of the revolution. The men were ready on the move. Take your blanket, take your son, report to General Washington. We've got our rights and now it's time to prove. Showed such determination that they won the admiration of countries across the sea like France and Spain, who loaned the colony ships and guns and put the British on the run and the Continental Army on its feet again. And though they lost some battles too, the Americans swore they'd see it through. Their raiding parties kept up hit and run. At Yorktown, the British could not retreat. Bottled up by Washington and the French fleet. Cornwallis surrendered, and finally we had won.
Hooray! On the shot heard round the world, for the end of the revolution, the Continental rabble took the day. And the father of our country beat the British there at Yorktown and brought freedom to you and me and the USA. God bless America.
Freedom ring.
And that was The Shot Heard Round the World by Schoolhouse Rock and The Patriots by Infinity Harmony Music. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to this broadcast of Outpost of Freedom Radio. Tonight, we are discussing public education. We are taking calls at this time. The call-in number is area code 530-576-5790. 530-576-5790. Alternatively, if you have Skype, you can add user OPF Radio to your contacts list. And if we bring you on that way, please mute your mic until we call for you. Or you can simply type your question to the listener chat room, and I will read them for you on the air. And while we wait for those lovely questions, comments, and so on and so forth, Gary, let's go ahead and look at some problems. How are the public schools funded now?
Well, back when they were funded by the ad valorem taxes, the tax millage rate was set, and usually the request was by the school board, and they would put the request out, which was based on the valuation of the property. There would be so much money coming in, and that was their budget, and they had to live within the budget. As time went on and government involvement came around and that ad valorem money went to general fund and the county and state started doling money out, they started setting up different methods of trying to be fair, setting up different methods. Now, one beauty of the old system, if you were in a nicer neighborhood with people that were likely to have more intelligent children because of the way they were brought up, you would probably also have more money coming in for the school, where if it was a slum neighborhood, you would have less coming in. Well, that was determined to be unfair, especially when the federal government got in. So the funding now is based on student days. So it might have been San Diego County, but somewhere in Southern California a couple years ago, the school district wanted to fine the parents $55 for every day their student was sick. So apparently the federal government is giving them $55 a student day, and they didn't like losing that $55 because somebody was too sick to go to school. So the money now is coming primarily from the federal government. They hold the purse string. The state government is still participating to some degree and has some degree of control over it. And the money that the school district, the school board now uses to buy the furniture, textbooks, and all that is probably an allocation based on number of students, some formula set up by the state and or federal government. So the method of funding has gone to one that you might call free market to one that's a mandate and an excess. Now, I ran across some numbers in something I was reading the other day. It was called Dumbing Down of America, and I'm going to assume the correctness of the information. Now, I think it was written around 2000, early 2000s, but since 1950, there has been a 96% increase in students and a 702% increase in staff.
Yeah, that ratio doesn't jive.
No, it doesn't. When I was in school, you know, we had teachers. They didn't have teacher's aides. In the office, we had a school nurse. In some schools, some of the smaller schools I went to didn't even have a school nurse. If there was a medical problem, they'd call somebody. I don't know who they'd call. You had a principal, the vice principal, the registrar, who was also the clerk at the counter. So you had three, maybe four people, maybe five in the office. And you had, Rolling Hills probably had 12 classrooms. So you probably had 12 teachers, not counting substitutes, because they'd only fill in when someone was missing, and 17 people, and that would probably be about 360 students. That 360 students nowadays, based upon this increase they're talking about, would be... about 450 teachers or staff members. It doesn't make sense. No, it doesn't take that much to make it work. But and why do teachers need an aide? I mean, they're educated in the educational process. Actually, they're educated in teaching theory, unfortunately. Why do they need an aide? For years, teachers got along teaching 30 students, no problem at all. But now they, every teacher has a teacher's aide. And then you've got, the, I guess, a phenomenal staff in the office to take care of paperwork. And that paperwork probably primarily has to do with counting and reporting student days to report to both state and federal government so you can get your allocations of funding. I guess we had a janitor, too, but I don't know if you call them staff or not. So the funding now has become a bottom-line mentality rather than a free market place, which it was 60 years ago, 50 years ago.
All right. We actually do have a question from the listener chat room. Evenhand asks, yes, if the practice of, quote-unquote, taking the summer months off originates from agrarian societies where the kids were needed to work the fields, what validity is there today in continuing the practice?
Well, I don't know if there is any, but I don't know. I never had a problem with summer vacation. I thought it was a great idea. If they're adapting to the real world, they probably should get 2 weeks a year, which they get at Christmas and Easter or used to. They had a Christmas break a year or a week and an Easter break a week. But to have a month or two or three off, I don't think disrupts the educational process, because I think being a child and outside of the discipline of school but with a peer group, part of growing up each year is getting along with that older peer group, and it can't, I don't believe it can all be done in school. So personally, my opinion is that summer vacation is a good idea. Yes, it did come from the agrarian necessity. When you look back at, well, West Point still doesn't have summer vacation. Annapolis doesn't have summer vacation. They have a couple weeks off a year. But I think as far as growing into a whole person, you have to have that social ability, the regular time with your peers as well. Doesn't mean that it can't go on longer, but, you know, holidays too. When I was in junior college, when I had to take algebra the second time, I barely passed the semester because I was attended, or the year, because I attended 181 days of the mandatory 180 days that I had to attend. So I was one day above not passing that year. That's when my grades went from A to D. But nowadays, there's so many vacations that, you know, traditionally, school would start and end at, you know, what were the two holidays, Labor Day and Memorial Day or something like that. But now they keep adding holidays and holidays and consolidating holidays and making holidays come on a Monday or Friday instead of on a weekend. And the school year is extending and extending, but there's no increase in school days. This is, I don't know what the reasoning behind that is, but it probably could be increased some, but I don't know that it's necessary. If there was a good program of teaching, I think there's plenty of time in the first 12 years of school to learn more than most students learn in junior college and perhaps college today.
Now, are the government schools inculcating the youth of today with an unmitigated reverence for government absolutism?
Well, I think that's the easiest question you've asked tonight. Hell yes. Two words. You see it all the time on the news, on these television programs for the teenage generation, everything. Government is the end all. Everything works because of government. Nothing works without government. We see that all the time. And yes, is it a byproduct of the school system? Absolutely. With no regard to the Constitution, I might add. I think another story, my wife and I were traveling west when I was traveling around the country talking about Waco, and we were somewhere in Illinois on the interstate highway, and we stopped at a rest area. And I hadn't seen these gas pumps before. It said, pay at the pump, and I didn't know how to pay at the pump, so I asked a kid, probably 16, 17, maybe 18 years old, how do I pay at the pump? And he showed me, and he said, don't you have a credit card? And I said, no, I believe in cash. And he said, cash? Why do you believe in cash? And I said, well, the Constitution says gold and silver, but I'll settle for cash, but I don't like credit. He said, the Constitution, that's obsolete. He had been taught that. Because the government doesn't want people to think and test what they're being taught in school against the Constitution. So, yes, that absolutism is definitely taught, and to me, that was a demonstration of it. If the Constitution's obsolete, then the government has replaced the Constitution as the law of the land, and anything they say or do is all right.
Yeah, I'm sorry, from what you just mentioned there, the first thing I thought of was that if it is true that the Constitution is indeed obsolete, then what in goodness sakes is the actual law? Now, I'm not talking about the legal code. I mean, what's the actual law here?
Whatever the government wants it to be.
Well, isn't that arbitrary?
Well, yes.
Oh, jeez.
Absolutism. Isn't that what that was in the question you asked?
Well, I mean, if that's the case, then what is the difference between, you know, some sort of communist dictatorship or some fascist corporatist amalgamation of centralized state power?
Or even a pagan tribe with a not-so-benevolent chieftain.
Fair.
Because if there's no standard, the Constitution be the chains that bind the government. When you take away those chains, you have government absolutism. Whatever you want to call it, we call it a democracy, but we're not, you know, I think we had one on voting, but, you know, we don't have a choice in who runs the government. We have a choice of from the select on who's going to screw us. And so government absolutism is basically a byproduct of the government education, government school system.
Ah, jeez. Well, then, I guess to kind of follow up in a little bit of a roundabout way then, why do you think that free market economics is not taught or at most not emphasized as much as probably should be in the public schools then?
Well, free market is not a theory. It's an exercise. It's a common sense thing. You know, what's the value of any product is what somebody's willing to pay for it. That's free market, basically. It also encourages via competition, not monopolies. It encourages a good product at a fair price when there's competition. Now, when government intervenes to take that away, you get into economic theory. But free market is not a theory, it's a practice. It's not a theory, it's a practice. It functions. It sustains itself. If you're still charging too much for something, nobody buys it, you have to lower the price or find something else to sell. It isn't based on government intervention or anything else. It should be taught, in a sense, as a history lesson because it works. It's worked throughout most of the history of this country. But instead, they're more inclined to teach economic theory. You know, they don't teach you how to balance a checkbook anymore. They tell you how to pay your credit card bill.
Yeah, or they teach you something along the lines of typical Keynesianism. How you create wealth is by spending it. And that somehow mystically doesn't really create wealth or all this nonsense. And how great central banking is, and inflation is the way, and you can inflate your way to prosperity, all these lies. That's what kind of comes out of the indoctrination centers, quite frankly.
Well, yeah, the idiocy. Everybody was so excited when the stock market set a record about a month ago, and I wrote that article about it and looked at what the value of the dollar was. I forgot what base year I used. 88 or 84 or something, when we had a record set. But actually, the record that was set a couple months ago was, if we look at the value of the dollar, was actually about 1/6 of the record that was set back in the 80s. So we get these bigger numbers, and we're deceived by them. You know, nickel candy bars cost a buck and a half. What's wrong with this picture? They don't teach the damage caused by inflation, because somebody might ask the question, well, when there is inflation, who gains? Well, the government gains, because they've printed more money and the buying power goes down, but they spent the money, and so that basically is the tax. These things aren't taught. If anything, they're teaching them how to, as you suggest, take advantage of the system now to better yourself by living in perpetual debt.
It's
a theory that I can't abide by.
Yeah, it's just completely disgusting and really just trashes any sort of notion of economic liberty or even property rights. Now, is value-based, I think you mentioned this before, is value-based education responsible for the rise of immorality in the recent generations?
Was value-based education responsible for the rise of immorality? Let's look at it a different way. Is value-based education responsible for the demise of morality? I think that's a better way of wording it. And the answer, again, is hell yes. Value-based is an interesting concept. Critical thinking is an interesting phrase. And I think to understand it, we have to look at critical thinking in a context of having a foundation before you do the critical thinking, or using the critical thinking to create the foundation. If I have a moral foundation and I do critical thinking, in a sense it's value-based, but it's based on a solid foundation. However, if I do the critical thinking to establish the moral foundation, then I have true value-based, where the value is what I think it should be, and that is probably what best serves me. So... value-based education is probably the worst thing that could have happened, and is, without a question, the primary element in education that is destroying this country. And when I say destroying this country, I mean it. This country is falling apart. A month or two ago, I used the analogy of talking with somebody that is, I feel like I'm living in an old rundown house, the floors are all scratched up and broken, the windows are cracked or broken, the walls are crumbling, and the roof's about ready to cave in. This country is falling apart, and the source of the demise of this country, the primary source, is the education that creates the foundation of these people that, once they get their diploma, think they know everything, and carry that immorality, that lack of respect for others, the lack of knowledge, the lack of everything, the ability to read, to write, to think.
Yeah, I mean, I can definitely, from experience, back you up on that, just from even at a collegiate level, my graduating class, it was just, I mean, they were very, yeah, I mean, some people would say they were pragmatic, but that's not quite right. It was more a combination of being amoral with just being very blind, quite honestly. I think that's probably the best way to put it. It was just, you know, whatever goes, goes, and, to hell with the consequences or the morality, or even just plain ethics of, frankly, anything. You know, if it the very worst notion, very worst context if it feels good, do it, and to hell with the consequences in one shape or form. I mean, that was pretty typical. And I even went, my alma mater was actually billed as a conservative, quote-unquote conservative university, public university. And so, goodness sakes, if you went to someplace like UCLA, Berkeley or something, which is not even billed as even being conservative – Lord knows it might even be more that way, but either way, it doesn't matter. The point is that it's systematic. It doesn't matter what something is being billed as. It's kind of emblematic, and I also understand it from different people I've talked to across the country about what their experiences in college were like. But back to that the values-based thing, I think Charlotte Isherbit, if I remember correctly, she said that it was also called like situational ethics. That was the term. That was the establishment term.
That's the one I was trying to think of. In any given situation, your ethics are what makes you feel best, most comfortable with. And it's not based on moral foundation.
Yeah, it's not based on a moral foundation. It's not even based on some sort of secular quasi-objective ethics like some people have tried to put together. It's just, you know, it's arbitrary. I mean, that is probably the best word. It is arbitrary. And I don't know, every definition of tyranny that I've looked in a legal dictionary, whether it's Black's Law Dictionary, Ballantyne's or Bouvier's, or Webster's 1828 dictionary, there I see a pattern where anytime you have government that's arbitrary, it is by definition tyrannical. And so if you have a generation of people who grow up morally, and I would say also more in some ways more importantly ethically, where everything is just arbitrary, their decisions with even just in their own personal lives are just arbitrary, some of those people are going to go into government as agents of the state. And whether it's a police officer, a judge, a legislator, or even just a friggin' bureaucrat. And my goodness sakes, if they've had situational ethics as a part of their upbringing, and then they come to and then they try to enforce their statutes, their legal code onto you, my goodness, if they can get away with it, they by golly will. It's all they've ever known.
If they can get away with it?
Okay, fair enough.
Are you living in the past? Or...
fair enough.
Let me read you from Webster's 1828, the definition of education, and this gives you an idea of how it was perceived by Jefferson. The bringing up as of a child, instruction, formation of manners. Education comprehends all that series of instruction and discipline which is intended to enlighten the understanding, correct the temper, and form the manners and habits of youth, and fit them for usefulness in their future stations. To give children a good education in manners, arts, and science is important. To give them a religious education is indispensable, and an immense responsibility rests on parents and guardians who neglect these duties. Now, this is before public schools. Now, which intend to enlighten their understanding, correct the temper, inform the manners and habits of youth, and fit them for usefulness in future stations. That's the purpose of education. Now, look at these people who come out of school now. What are they fit for? Standing in a welfare line. Menial jobs.
Yeah. Service jobs, too.
You know, when I was in Pittsburgh, a friend of mine, had an engineering degree. I'm not sure whether mechanical or electric. He worked for PPG, Pittsburgh Plate Glass. He had gone 4 years in college to get his degree in engineering. He'd been certified by the association. And the janitor who went to work at PPG the year that he went to college was making twice what he was.
Gee whiz.
Now, he might have eventually passed the janitor. But the janitor, because of unions in Pittsburgh, had moved up the scale in those 4 years, increasing his worth, even though all he did is push a broom. So we've got a society that, and look at the people now, with college degrees that can't get a job. And one of the problems is, since they have a college degree, they are demanding more than they're worth simply because they've got that degree and they've got to pay off that debt because the government gave them the money to go to school on.
There's also one other problem besides that. It kind of follows on the principle of inflation in that the more of a, let's just say, currency you have, the less its value, the purchasing power goes down. Similarly, you could say that about several different types of commodities or goods or whatever. But look at college degree, look at just your average run-of-the-mill, even bachelor's degree. The more of those you have, the less special you – I mean the more of those that just exist for – it doesn't matter what your field of study was. The more of those that exist, the less valuable they are. Ergo, you're less special if you have a bachelor's. And the same would apply to master's and doctorates.
Well,
so,
see, when I, in the 50s, what I learned in the lower levels of school carried me for a long time. In the ninth grade, like I said, I barely passed. In the 10th grade, I think I got through the whole school year, probably with a D or C average because I'd go surfing every day. My 11th year in school, I got kicked out of school, and that's when I went back to Florida to spend a semester in Miami school system. And my senior year, I got kicked out of school again. This is L.A. schools that I got kicked out of. And so I ended up in the Army, and I was in basic training when my class graduated, 1964. From there, in the Army, I got a GED. So at the point that I got my GED without studying, my foundation in education was those first 8 years of school. Now, when I look back at that time, I would say if I had gone all the way through high school in Palos Verdes, where we did have a higher standard of education, that the education I would have gotten in the 12th grade, by the 12th grade, would exceed what most students get in college now, except in their specialized area of study. But as far as general education and some of the specialized study, what I got in 12 was equivalent to what they get in 16. Junior colleges have become overrated high schools, and colleges have become low-class high schools. And that's about the quality of education, and that's the supply and demand. When you've got too many people pursuing it and you've got to teach down to them, everybody that's part of that system is taught down, and the only people that excel are those that pursue a specialized area, not basket weaving or social engineering or, you know, the liberal arts aren't for the most part that much use. You know, that's where we get the counselors that come up with theories in education. So what they're getting now is nothing. Now, I wonder what it was like back in the 30s when I read, I've got a book here of questions for common schools from the 1870s, or 1856. And when I look at that book, the questions that they had to answer in common school are beyond my subsequent years in college. And they were getting this in the common school, which basically was 8 or 10 years of education. So, yeah, the diploma has become worthless unless you have a hole in your wall and need something to cover it.
Yeah, and that's the other thing, too. I mean, a lot of and I can say this since I've in one sense, I've been on both sides of the fence. I mean, I learned more as a homeschooler than I did most. I mean, there was some stuff in college that was good, usually pertaining to my field of study. But most of the stuff I learned in college was either garbage or irrelevant or not to the degree necessary to really learn the material. And so I've learned much more just, you know, homeschool, quite frankly. And actually, one thing I want to get down before I forget that was related to something that we mentioned earlier. You know, so I hear complaints within the Patriot community about police brutality. And you mentioned, and Gary, you mentioned earlier about you know the situational ethics with somebody at a public school, a product of the public school system, you know, not thinking it's immoral or unethical to beat up a homeless man. Well, combining that with what I said a moment ago about the, you know, one of those people becoming, you know, a government agent, is anybody really surprised that police brutality or, you know, beatings, whatever? Or in certain cases, just cold-blooded murder, like what happened with Oscar Grant or Jose Guarnera, actually occur in the first place. You know, that's just something, just 2 cents to keep in mind. So, yeah.
Well, government absolutism. These guys go into government, and they're the absolute authority at that point. They're given a gun, and, you know, to me, I've always probably getting a little risque in this demonstration, but I knew a female cop in Winter Springs, Florida, and you know, she got to strap her dick on every day and go to work. Now, the cops do, too. They strap their dick on and go to work. They call it a gun, but they, this is my rifle, this is my gun, this is for shooting, this is for fun. I'm not sure what they call it. But, yeah, they've got a chip on their shoulder. And, you know, years ago, I think it was in the 80s, they started maybe in the 70s because of all the police brutality back in the 70s, especially evolving out of the Vietnam War demonstrations. They decided to do psychological testing of people who seeking jobs in law enforcement. And for the most part, they gave that up because they couldn't find enough qualified candidates. They dropped the idea of psychological testing to make sure these people weren't abusive because nobody with any intelligence wanted the damn job.
Okay. Well, I didn't want to go off too much on the policing, but I think it was important to kind of draw the connection between public education and certain effects, courtesy of situational ethics or value-based education, whatever the establishment, whatever the current version of the establishment term is. But for our listeners, if you want to learn more about the police, please refer to our previous episode entitled How to Talk to a Cop If You Want to. Anyway, continuing on, Gary, is public education responsible for the reluctance of students to even consider the reasonableness of the Constitution and the government created by it?
Well, I think we kind of alluded to that. And yes, I think definitely so, because they don't teach them the Constitution. They don't teach them to how to think. What does this say? We the people, what does that mean? Well, we give it to the government. I don't know how they look at these things if they even read it in school. I've talked to attorneys that admit that they haven't read the Constitution since high school. They didn't even read it in law school. So when you accept government absolutism, you have a conflict if you accept the Constitution as well. They just don't fit together. So obviously the government wants to teach government absolutism. They have to belittle the Constitution. That was reasonable 200 years ago. In fact, I just heard that the other day. But, man, it's outdated now. We're in a new world. And we've got, you know, if anything, we need to rewrite the Constitution and do a good job like we did for Iraq, if you ever read it. So, yes, it's responsible for the reluctance of students to consider the Constitution as the source of government, rather than the government's existence as the source of government.
Okay, and just something that occurred to me. For our more libertarian listeners, just keep in mind when we are referring to government absolutism, we are talking about statism. That's the same. Those are just synonyms for. So basically big government, tyrannical, arbitrary, just something out of the worst pit of hell, basically. Not a limited government with delegated powers and that sort of situation. Okay, we do have a question from the listener chat room. Reddington asks, haven't old people been complaining about immoral youths for over 100 years?
Well, yeah, there's a phrase when I was a kid called juvenile delinquency, and we didn't see it as that. We were pranksters, and we did things that we probably shouldn't have done, but... Yes, I think that, you know, generational changes, and I've tried to keep that in mind, but understand since World War II, the rate of progression, and I'm going to use this term in a different sense than we will when we do the verbicide program, the rate of progression of knowledge, of abilities, of technology, and all this stuff since World War II has been phenomenal. Every 10 years, we will learn more than was known prior to that. So the rate of progression in human understanding is growing at a rapid rate. When we look at the antics of kids, I had uncles and even my father, though my mother never would, admit that they did a lot of things. We did, but they didn't have rock and roll music. So the criticism back when I was a kid was rock and roll music, primarily. Juvenile delinquency has been around forever. Somebody posted something in the chat about Bill Cody pulling out a knife and stabbing a guy in the thigh. Yeah, that's not a good thing to do, but it happened back then. So I think a lot of it more is more on a social level than anything else. If they look back, you know, I don't listen to rap music. My son and I were going on a trip to Arizona once from California, and he played with the radio and got this god-awful stuff up there. I think he called it rap music, and I said, not on my radio. And he didn't understand that. So in some respects, we look back on it, but in other respects, we haven't changed a bit. Prankster-type things have gone on all through history. They're just in different settings. And I expect that will always happen. Now, I've tried to avoid it. I have tried to not impose what my children listen to unless I happen to be in close confinement with them.
Okay, so I guess this is probably the penultimate question then with regards to really a huge aspect of the problem. Have public schools become virtual prisons?
Just about. They have a work-release program. They let them go home in the afternoon. But, yeah, from the pictures I've seen recently, schools, especially in larger cities, generally have security fencing all the way around. They have armed guards. If not, they have at least guards. And I don't know if that's what if Ezerbit was talking about rent-a-cops that were part of the staff or not. I think she was talking about the administrative staff. But some schools, they even lock them in the classroom during the hours, and the teacher has a key and can let them out to go potty or whatever they have to do, go smoke a cigarette or a joint in the restroom, whatever they're doing. But they have become that. When I was a kid, we could walk off campus, whether in Miami or in California. We could walk off campus and did school. There were no guards there. The only fence was around the athletic field, and that was to keep, and that was only true in some of the schools that I went to, and that was to keep pranksters out from going up and, you know, tearing up the football field or something like that. But usually a gate was open all the time. Public parks were open all the time, too. So, in a sense, they have become a form of prison. Perhaps this is part of the conditioning process to get people to understand that government absolutism will put them in prison, in this virtual prison, whenever they want to, and get used to the idea. But, yes, they have, and it goes back to the value-based, primarily the value-based problem. Very seldom do you have an outsider going to shoot up a school. I think I can only recall one incident many years ago, and I think it was in California, where an outsider went and shot up a school. Otherwise, you've got students shooting up school. And maybe they're rebelling against what they're saying, and their psychotropic drugs have resorted, along with the value-based education, have pushed them into this extreme reaction to what they're rebelling against. I know when I was in jail the first few times, it's a strange feeling to feel like a caged animal. That's all you think of. I'm an animal in a cage. And I wonder how much of that plays on people's minds and whether they develop an acceptance of it or a partial acceptance or a toleration of it and then rebel against it with the psychotropic drugs. It's hard to say. But, yes, the world has changed.
Now, before
I would call it progress.
Yeah, that's probably one of those verb-sided words. Now, before we move on to solutions, we do have a question and I think it's a comment from the listenership. All right, now this question kind of came over Skype, so I'm not going to reveal the identity of who asked it, but here it is. Public education is one of those topics that is mentioned in Gary's Divide and Conquer article. So why are you guys doing a show on it if focusing on, I think he means on it, is a distraction and doesn't help us take our country back?
Well, I was suggesting that you read, and we have to have the link man find the link for this one, The Plan for Restoration of Constitutional Government. We're doing this program more as a solution than a problem. When it was addressed in Divide and Conquer, within the existing system, you can't change it. But I've heard so much resentment over the public school system from people almost as old as me. They say that, you know, we should not have public education. What they mean is we should not have government education. However, if we're ever going to regain this country, which is what the Plan for Restoration of Constitutional Government is about, and the link that he can give you again to the link to Thoughts on Public Education is solution-oriented, because if we're going to get back our education system, it's not going to come through the ballot box or the jury box. It's going to come through the cartridge box. But when it comes, we have to know where we're going. Why start from scratch then, learning what public education should be and what's happened to it to give us the perception we have of it generally today? So this is solution-oriented, not problem-oriented. The solution, though, will not come easily.
Okay, and again, right before we start addressing some of those things, I guess this was a part of an article that was put in the chat room, and it actually is relevant. This was an article from the WashingtonExaminer.com. Link is in the chat room. I think the title of it is McDonald's Owners Say There Is No College Requirement for the Job. Oh, wait, no, that's... Okay, anyway, the article says, with colleges producing more graduates and youth unemployment at a sky-high 11.5%, actually it's higher, but I'll say that for another time. The article says 11.5. Even landing a job selling Big Macs is getting competitive. Consider a job opening at a Massachusetts McDonald's restaurant for a full-time cashier requiring 1 to 2 years' experience in cash handling and a bachelor's degree.
Now that just creates more problems in the system, doesn't it? Because to be a cashier in a McDonald's, now you've got to have at least a bachelor's degree.
Yeah. Oh, let me.
That means if I want to be a cashier in McDonald's, I've got to go to college and get a 4-year degree to learn what I should have learned in high school.
Okay. Oh, this is interesting. Just some quick follow-up. Here is the title, so you guys listening later in the podcast version can do a search for it. Headline reads, McDonald's want to add demands bachelor's degree, 2 years experience for cashier. There was an update that had linked to another article said McDonald's, no bachelor's degree needed. Basically, McDonald's is blaming some sort of third-party employment website for misunderstanding what they were saying.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm good. Then I will occasionally allow my daughters to take me to a McDonald's.
Well, but in any case, it's interesting that the initial want ad would be a bachelor's degree in 2 years cash handling experiments. I mean, that's pretty, even if it was a mistake, I mean, somebody actually had to write that up, though.
Well, it's gotten that way because it makes it easier for the human resources people. If you don't have a degree, you needn't apply here. But think what that does to the system. We need a janitor. I want to apply for the janitor's job. Do you have a college degree? No, I don't. I'm sorry. We are not taking you. Why do you need a degree for a job that you should have learned how to do in high school? Why do you need 4 more years of education to fill these jobs? Because it makes it easier on the HR people, because they can exclude when they have 10 job openings and 3,000 applications. They can get rid of probably 2,000 applications by saying they don't have a degree. So now they've only got 1,000 people to deal with for those 10 jobs.
Yeah, and getting in, yeah.
Then that burdens the system even more, forcing the quality of education in the college to go down. It's a self-defeating proposition.
Right, and obviously something like, that John Milton English class I took in college has nothing to do with flipping burgers. That's kind of another problem. But yes, that article was posted by Reddington. He was the fellow who asked the earlier question about immoral youths for over 100 years. Okay, now let's get to solutions. Gary, Is homeschooling your children?
Hold on a second. This just reminded me of something.
Sure.
When I was a kid, making out meant kissing a girl.
Right.
My brother and I were talking once in front of my mother and said, making out, my mother got red in the face. When she was a kid, making out meant taking your pants down.
Mm.
So, morality changes. The what do they call them? The flippers or flappers or whatever it was back in the 30s.
Flappers.
There's constant social change, music and things like that, that might be perceived as moral degeneration, but adultery in that sense has been around for a long time. Mistresses and prostitution. Prostitution was more common in this country 100 years ago than it is now. So is it moral degeneration? Or is prostitution even immoral in the first place? It's a very subjective determination, and we tend to try and live in our own worlds and judge the rest of the world like that. And a good example of that is people criticize Thomas Jefferson for owning slaves. Some are even criticizing George Washington for owning slaves. They had a dilemma. They couldn't get rid of their slaves. They couldn't just turn them loose. That'd be like taking a six-year-old child with no education at all, telling him to go out and make a living. He can't do it. But we judge them by the standard of today without consideration, which is why we're backing up in history and a lot of these things we talk about. Let's look at what it was like 200 years ago. Our cops constitutional is a good example. What were cops like 200 years ago? They weren't like today. But if we perceive that the world has always been as we see it now, then we can't find a solution to the problem. We've got to start from scratch. But if we look back at what worked, we have a solution in hand.
Yeah, and regardless of someone's own personal moral code, homosexuality has survived well over a millennia.
Yeah,
so yeah,
stop stoning them.
Yeah, but the point being is that whatever, or kind of like Lysander Spooner said, vices are not crimes. I mean, any which way you look at it, it will survive somehow.
But moral standards will change too from time to time. They'll get loose.
Right.
They'll get tight. Prohibition. There's a lot of alcoholics. Prohibition, more alcoholics. End of prohibition, less alcoholics. Sometimes the unintended consequences of the action of the government are a major factor in the changes in morality.
Right.
They don't have suffrage. What were they? The drinking marches. I forgot what they called them, but they used to have these. Alcohol is evil. Outlaw alcohol.
The prohibitionists.
Yeah, there was another word for it when they did the demonstrations at first. Prohibition was the 18th Amendment. There's another word for it. It doesn't matter. The thing is, those are cyclic. We look back. Flippers or flappers, whatever they called them, were loose women. Period. And,
right.
Then they got out of that. And in the 60s, I guess, the free love 60s was interesting. But then we've gotten out of that, too. And now it's oral sex, I think.
Or whatever version it is, right. All right, everybody, we are taking calls at this time. The call-in number is area code 530-576-5790. Again, 530-576-5790. Alternatively, if you have Skype, you can add user OPF Radio to your contacts list, and if we bring you on that way, please mute your mic before we bring you on. Or you can simply type your question into the listener chat room, and I will read them for you on the air. Okay.
Hold on a second. Kibler wrote something in here.
Sure.
Wife is manager at McDonald's, and she said that those requirements come from people not being able to change a $5 bill without the register. Every once in a while, I still go in and buy something. I went down to this little drugstore here in Las Moinas. It's a pharmacy, and back in front, it's a trinket store, the stuff my wife buys to put on shelves. There's nothing else in there. But when I went to pay them, the lady took the money and counted back my change, 16, 50, 75, 17, 18, 19, 20, the way they used to do it. And why people can't, you know, that should be taught in school, how to make change. It was when I was a kid. But people can't do it now without a machine. And they can be college graduates and still not do it without the machine to do it for them. You know, how much was tendered? And if they screw that up, very few of them, they're befuddled at that point. They have to call a manager and say, look, I put in the wrong number on how much you gave me. Now, if they put in the wrong number, I mean, one time this lady put in, I think it was $18.27, and so I gave her 20 and 27 cents, so she put in $20, and she couldn't figure it out what to do. Well, it would have been $2. But instead, I said, okay, give me the 27 cents back. Now I gave you 20, and now you're dealing with 18.27, so give me my change. So I ended up with a lot more change than I wanted because they're so damn stupid when they come out of school.
That's pathetic. I mean, we're not talking about something like quadratic equations. I mean, this is adding and subtracting.
Yeah, Kevlar, thanks for bringing that up because I think, you know, that is something that I always get a kick out of, how stupid people are that are on cash registers.
Yeah, but they're being made that way. I mean, that's the problem.
That's right. They're a product of the government education system, not the public education system, because it no longer – public means the people. If you look up the definition of public, and we will cover this on the Verbicide program, which was going to be tonight, but we shifted things. The Verbicide program will talk about what's happened to various words, how the change in meaning has changed what it is. Public means belongs to the people as a whole. It doesn't mean belongs to the government. At best, the government is the caretaker on behalf of the people. So public education then belongs to the people. How come it belongs to the federal government now? It's government education. It's not public education today. Get that idea out of your mind. When you say public education, you are lying, because it is not. If you're homeschooling, you could call it public education or private education. If you go to a tutor, likewise. But if you go to a private school, parochial school, or what do they call these other schools that they have now? They're bound by curriculum. Even the Catholic Church has to demonstrate some obedience to the government curriculum program. So we don't have public education. We have government education. It's dictated, mandated by the government.
All right, let's get to solutions then. Gary, is homeschooling your children an actual solution?
Well, I have 18-year-old twin daughters right now. When we lived in Mesa, this is about 18, up to about 14 years ago, maybe 13 years ago. The neighbors were two grades ahead of my daughters, and my daughters were teaching them things. My daughters were homeschooled. They still are. This is their last year, finally. We went at a pace that suited us with vacations and all that. But I would put my two girls against anybody in the senior year or a graduate of a high school, and I would give good odds that 9 times out of 10, if not more, they would demonstrate greater ability to think, to problem solve, to comprehend, and to have an understanding of history, ethics, morality, and these issues that should be in education. And there are a lot of good programs. We use what's called BEKA, B-E-K-A, but online you can find dozens of resources for education. Now, when I go through the BEKA stuff, there's some stuff, I'll tear some pages out of the books, quite frankly, because I think they're tending towards this value-based stuff or green earth stuff. And I don't believe in, and that's the theory too, the green earth stuff. I don't believe the theory should be taught in school unless it's the Pythagorean theorem or something like that. But if the parents pay attention and one of the parents has the time to homeschool, it's amazing what the children can learn. Now, interestingly, my wife and I's rub is I think they should get dressed and sit at the table to study, but my one daughter does her schoolwork in her pajamas in bed. But she's learning, so, hey, I can't knock it. And the motivation's there. They enjoy the homeschool. If they want a day off, we can give them a day off. The regimentation that the school has doesn't have to be as rigid. Maybe that's not good if they're going to go do manual work, but I prefer that they become wives and mothers rather than become a part of the workforce, so I don't think it detriments from that. But it is a solution, and it's probably the only one because you have complete control. Now, every state has some rules about education. We haven't necessarily abided by them. We have no intention of abiding by them. We are making the decisions ourselves on what they will learn and what they will not learn. But it is legal in every state in one form or another, and I think Texas said you're supposed to inform the school that you're homeschooling putting your child in private school, not homeschooling, because private school is legal and homeschooling is not legal, or something like that.
It's a weird technical distinction. I don't remember the exact verbiage, but yes, you're right. It's technically okay, provided you inform the government that you're not sending your kid to the indoctrination center.
Now, what we've done, should the question ever arise, is I've got a box in the garage called first grade, and it's got all their work from the first grade, and I've got one marked second grade, and it's all their work from the second grade, all the way up. And so we retain that should the need ever arise. And if not, hey, we'll give it to them, and they can show it to their children. But we have never endeavored to appease the government on the quality of education for our children. If it's ever challenged, I'm going to tell them to pick five students and sit them across the room from my daughters, and let's see who's smarter.
Very nice. You mentioned a moment ago about, you know, your daughters are becoming mothers or other people's daughters or what have you, and it just kind of occurred to me that not all work is wage labor. You know, there's a lot of things we do in our off time. There are people with certain types of occupations where they don't have a constraining 9-to-5 day job or something. So, and there's also all kinds of work that's not paid either. You do it out of love or out of charity or other reasons. So I think there's a misconception big time with people who are products of the government schools that, if it's not wage labor, then it's not work.
Well, yeah, see, we've got, and here we get back to, you know, morality and ethic. We've got thousands of years of women's duties being near the home. Now, it could be burdensome, and in many societies it was. They had very heavy work. They had to run the garden. They had to do all that. The American Indians, the women had to pack up the teepee and get it on the travois so they could move, or they used to have to drag it before they had horses. They did all the work. All the men did was hunt and fight. And otherwise, they'd just lounge around. But the woman's work was always close to home. There's probably a good reason for that if you apply a little common sense. Men don't get pregnant. And that being said, if you can't understand why women should stay home and take care of the house, they were designed for it.
Well, I think there's a couple other things to consider as well. I think there was a link put up in the chat room to something called an old-fashioned education, and that is a terrific website for learning how to basically put together your own pretty much custom-made homeschooling curriculum. And what's fantastic about that one is that, well, first of all, it's customizable, which is fantastic. It is provided in the context of a Christian education, so do keep that in mind for your own purposes. But again, it's customizable, so that's not a problem for certain folks who believe a different way. But the other thing that's really great about it is that the webmaster demonstrates how you can put together a homeschooling curriculum just from sources on the internet. One of the main sources she uses is Project Gutenberg. And you can even customize. You don't even have to like print out whole books. You can print out portions of books, like portions you need to do like a literature reading, or print out portions of certain math problems, or what have you. So that's a fantastic resource just to peruse and kind of, I'm not saying you should use it necessarily, but kind of get an idea that, you know, as a parent, you can make this happen if you really want to. And then for some other folks who are a little bit more recalcitrant on homeschooling or even private schooling, you know, there was an article that went up earlier today about DARE, which, of course, is the drug abuse resistance education that the establishment liked to push, especially during the 90s, and it's still around. And I think something that a lot of people kind of overlook, and this is of particular interest to the Patriot community, by the way, this particular detail, is that DARE has been used as a way of getting children to snitch.
Turn in your parents.
To snitch on their parents to the police. So, for instance, and it doesn't matter what your specific political orientation is. Generally speaking, if you either own and use firearms, you use what the enemy rebel government considers illicit narcotics, you have an unorthodox lifestyle, quote-unquote, in one way, shape, or form, you have certain, quote-unquote, unusual behaviors in the bedroom, whatever it all is. If it's suspicious, quote-unquote suspicious, remember DHS with the see something, say something, you know, Big Brother Orwellian program they had a while back. I mean, DARE was well before all that, and it was the same thing, but it was targeting children specifically, emulating what the Soviet Union did, where the commies were basically all telling the kids, especially those in the, what was it called, like the youth communist or communist youth league or whatever the term was, to you know, snitch on their parents if they have counter-revolutionary views or they want to make money, you know. And so the version now is, well, you know, is mommy smoking, you know, funny-smelling plants? You know, does daddy like to go shoot on the weekends? Snitch on your parents, kids. It's fun. We'll even – and I think some offshoots of DARE have actually offered cash rewards. And that was actually a few years ago. They actually – I remember an ad where they actually – where a cop came into the
Don't want to go too far into DARE. We're going to be doing a Behind Enemy Lines program in the near future along about money laundering, which involves DARE. But I got to tell a story about DARE. This is probably back in the early 70s, that under the DARE program, it might have been later, I don't recall, but under the DARE program, a girl had turned in her parents for smoking marijuana. Her parents were charged. They were convicted. They were going to prison. The girl was going to a foster home. The television station covered the girl after the conviction of her parents when she was told that they were going to prison, and she was crying her eyes out. And she, until then, did not realize the damage that she had caused, the destruction of her family. They are told that this is the right thing to do and nothing bad will happen. Just tell us. And this is worse than what Hitler did, probably. When the reality really hits the child, when they've turned in their parents, and one parent or both in this case, go to prison, and they've lost that parent or those parents and end up in a foster home or with relatives they don't like or even like, but mommy and daddy are gone, it's devastating to the child. Can that child ever recover in their life respect for themselves after what they did to their parents? My guess is no.
Yeah, and really the only other thing I'll say about DARE that's relevant for right now is to the listeners, you know, patriots, libertarians, listen up, guys. Find out in your own local areas whether DARE is still active or not. And if DARE is not active, try to find out whether there's been a replacement type quote-unquote drug abuse education government program replaced instead. And if it's the case, it might be replacement. Look for the telltale signs. Like in the curriculum, it actually tells the children to, you know, snitch on their parents or any of these weird educational theories that are not really educational.
Being a law-abiding citizen or some cover-up.
Right. Look for stuff that's suspicious. And again, it's in the article that's linked in the chat room. But Yeah, and just consider this. I mean, if it does turn out, you either have the actual DARE thing locally where you and sorry, let me collect my thoughts for a moment. Contact the local school, your local school district. Also contact your local county sheriff and as well as any applicable city or town police departments and ask them whether they have a DARE program. Because remember, DARE is actually taught. That's a weird thing about it. It's actually taught by police officers, not by teachers. I mean, that's just bizarre. I mean, think about that for a second. Would you expect public school teachers to chase down muggers or, you know, pull people over for a moving violation? Okay, and if the answer is no, then why do you expect, you know, a member of the standing army, because that's what police officers are, why do we expect a member of the standing army to go into a public school and teach children anything? It doesn't make any sense, unless there's something else going on. But again, I don't want to get too deeply into that, but as far as an action step to take, is find out if that's the case in your area. If it is the case, either the actual DARE program or a replacement one that basically is DARE in all but name, then you may want to start considering pulling your kid out because you now have a risk of your child being manipulated, especially the younger they are. It's just a fact of life. I mean, it's the life we have. It's the times we're living. So just consider that. And if you don't want to do homeschooling but you can afford something, you know, private school is another option. But you have options. So just find out first whether it's an issue or not. Some areas are free of that. Other areas are not. Just depends where you live. Okay, now speaking about homeschooling, we did have a questioner from the listener chat room. Matt asks, would you advocate homeschooling other people's children if their mother is in the workforce, or what is your solution for that?
If your wife is homeschooling or if you're homeschooling and you're willing to take on other students and their parents are willing to give let you go there. I don't know how the state law is about a non-relative, but I would do it. Yes, the more children that are homeschooled, the better off our future is. If you understand that we've got, I don't know how many million students graduating from high school every year, and they've all been indoctrinated, and very few can break the bonds of that indoctrination. When they leave high school, and it's so ingrained in them, and every year after they graduate, it's more entrenched in their belief system. The best thing we can do is get as many people out there as possible that can think straight, and maybe socially, just in conversation, these people that were indoctrinated will begin to realize that this ain't right. And if we want to restore constitutional government, there's going to have to be enough people that understand the Constitution. I think it's a great idea. I would not go 501c3 because if you do that, then you're becoming one of these schools that's bound by the government. So you've got to do it under the table or voluntarily. But I think it's a great idea. We didn't do it because we've tended to live when we were in Phoenix, Arizona. We lived around all these people that had their kids in public schools, and they, oh, you homeschool? You know, it was kind of a look down their nose at us. And where we live now is out in the country, and there's nobody near us. The nearest children are probably 2 miles away from us. So it wouldn't be practical here. But I do have some friends that are about 5 or 10 miles from here. They homeschool their children. And over in, where they are on the other side of the river, there's a larger group that they get together and they have sport events, they have teams, they compete with other teams. So if you're in a community where there's other homeschoolers, get with them too, and you can get some extracurricular activities going between the children so they can play with, have a peer group that is truly peers, people that are educated instead of indoctrinated.
Let me add on to that. I can say from experience that something that actually has been done in many areas is they're known as homeschooling co-ops. Literally, parents within a given geographical you know, dense area or close-knit area will have their kids kind of form impromptu classrooms, and one of the parents will – excuse me. There's two versions. One version is where all the parents in the co-op hire a tutor and the tutor teaches – or, and this is actually more common due to financial reasons and other reasons, is that one of the parents who actually has a specialty or otherwise is knowledgeable in a certain subject area will teach a class over a period of weeks or whatever. And I actually took part in one of those back when I was a homeschooler. And that was great. I loved it. I wish I could do it more. Just more wasn't available. So, you know, if you want to raise up the next generation of, patriots and libertarians and other types of people like that, homeschooling co-ops, cost-effective, and they friggin' work. The only issue in terms of pragmatically making it happen is that it requires time and effort. But if you're willing to put the labor in and you're intelligent and competent in your subject area and also providing there's enough demand, but I'm assuming that there is, you can totally make it happen. In fact, consider this. Also, this other aspect. A lot of the alternative media, unfortunately, now is, well, I don't want to get into the problems of that, but suffice it to say, there was, please refer to the, actually it was a YHTOM episode entitled You Have Tread On Me that I did with Randy Mack. But something I want to add on to that's relevant here, even the best parts of the alternative media are right now kind of doing a educational role, such as what we're doing here at OPF Radio. But consider this, what is easier? Is it easier in the long term to try and kind of do an ex post facto education in the Constitution and things like that and liberty and freedom? Or is it better to do that from the beginning when somebody is growing up from the start, kind of the analogy of the tree? You know, it's easier to, you know, mold a tree or grow a tree straight rather than try and, you know, bend a tree that's on the older side. Just something to keep in mind. So I can't emphasize that enough.
Let me explain one more benefit to homeschooling that just occurred to me while you were talking. And my wife is 11 years younger than me. Therefore, she didn't start school until I was out of high school almost. Actually, I was in the Army when she was starting school. She has overcome a lack of education by being the instructor in homeschool. So your wife is going to get that education she was denied by the government if she becomes the homeschool teacher.
Yes, it's very much a two-way street. And also for Matt and anyone else who's more interested in homeschooling, also please refer to the other YHTOM episode that we have up in the archive that was entitled Homeschooling for Dissidents. Which I also did with Randy Mack. So we've kind of covered this before in another sense. But this is one solution anyway. It's also good as a current mitigation of sorts to get, you know, kind of pull people out of the system as it is now. It's got that immediacy, which is really good and beneficial. Moving on though, Gary. Should the provision of educational services belong exclusively to the free market?
Where else could you put it? If we have a school district and we have a school teacher and not student evaluation of instructors, but we noticed that they're in an English class and they're learning how to say como se llama usted, you dump that teacher. Yes, the free marketplace. What are the results? Not by testing, but by observation by the parents. This teacher is not doing a good job teaching. Let's get rid of her. And you got a good teacher, it might be competitive. You might have to pay her a little more. But I remember some school teachers when I was a kid that were old school. Miss Brubaker in particular, she was a teacher. She didn't care about the pay. Her commitment in life was to educate children to go into the world and be good people. That was her purpose in life. If they had cut her pay, she would have complained and come to work the next day. She wouldn't go on strike for more money like they do in Wisconsin. So, yes, free marketplace. I mean, you know, now they're tenured. They have contracts, long-term contracts. They have unions behind them. They don't have to be good, and the quality of education is a direct result of the consequences of removing it from the free market and putting it in the government's pocket in determination of criteria and contract and everything else.
All right, then, as we begin to close out tonight's broadcast, then, Gary, can the original concept of public schools, especially that as envisioned and understood by the founders, be restored then?
Well, yes, and alluded to that in answering a question earlier on. This is a solution, yes. Can it happen within the existing structure? Probably not. The unions are too entrenched. The government is too entrenched. It has to come back to us. The plan for restoration of constitutional government has that incorporated into it. Once you have secured your county and made it constitutional, then your education within that county becomes constitutional. It becomes public education, and it becomes subject to the will of the people in that community. It is the solution to the problem. There is no other. If we go on the course we're going on now, you might start naming your children tomato. Well, that's a fruit, isn't it? Tomato, carrot, things like that, because they are going to be vegetables. Now, I'm going to repeat. This is where at the end of the program. Probably the single most damaging contribution of government to the demise of the greatness of America is its taking over the educational system by the application of theories promulgated by strange people who had a better idea and ended up taking away the greatness that existed in this country through 1930.
That's pretty profound.
What would 50% of students dropping out of school for homeschooling do to the economy that the teachers that are left wouldn't complain about wages anymore? You're absolutely right. You know, that could force them into a free market economy, but more than likely the union would determine who would stay, and it would be based on longevity, not on qualifications. But yes, it might be interesting to throw some of those greedy teachers, untrained, uneducated teachers, back into the workplace, because there are plenty of brooms without operators. That was Kevlar's question there, or comment. It would be interesting, but I don't think you'll get 50% of the people by a long shot. I don't think that you'll get 1% of the people to homeschool. I know that I've got some friends that have no respect for parents who won't care enough about their children to homeschool them. But in this day and age, and we're so stuck on things, that we believe, and to pay the taxes, all this money the government wants from us, you almost have to have two working parents. Once I became a surveyor, my wife never had to work again. My first wife chose to, my second wife chose to, my third wife is, and that's all, just three. My third wife has never really worked, and she doesn't have to. The society that we should have will come when we get back to the principles that made the country great. We've got to get back there. If it can be affected by getting more people to homeschool, there's no doubt that generations from now we would see an effect if we have that long. But who knows how the government would counteract that. They would probably outlaw homeschooling, and most people then would be scared into compliance.
Well, and who knows? Maybe in the future there will be such a thing as, homeschooling civil disobedience style. But anywho, Gary, I'd like to thank you very much for joining us tonight to discuss public education. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you once again, Sleepy, and thank you all for listening. Good night.
All right, everyone, that is going to conclude this episode of OPF Radio. Please join us for future podcasts that will be made available on our website over at www.outpost-of-radio.com. outpost-freedom.com/radio. Again, that is outpost-of-freedom.com/radio. Also, feel free. All lowercase, yes, very much so. Outpostoffreedom.com/radio. Also, feel free to refer to our previous broadcast of OPF Radio for how to roleplay for such things like how to roleplay police encounters, how to stop banking, forming your own security teams, and probably most importantly, taking the initiative. Be free, stay free, and laissez-faire.
I had a dream the other night that, well, I didn't understand. A figure walked in through the mist with a flintlock in his hand. His clothes were torn and dirty as he stood there by my bed. He took off his three-cornered hat, and speaking low to me, he said, "We fought a revolution to secure our liberty. We wrote the Constitution as a shield from tyranny. For future generations, this legacy we gave. In this, the land of the free. And home of the brave. The freedoms we secured for you, we hoped you'd always keep. But tyrants labored endlessly while your parents were asleep. Your freedom's gone, your courage lost, you're no more than a slave. In this, the land of the free, and home of the brave. You buy permits to travel and permits to own a gun, permits to start a business or to build a place for one. On land that you believe you own, you pay a yearly rent. Although you have no voice in saying how the money's spent. Your children must attend a school that doesn't educate. And your Christian values can't be taught according to the state. You read about the current news in a regulated press. And you pay a tax you do not owe to please the IRS. Your money is no longer made of silver nor of gold. You trade your wealth for paper so your life can be controlled. You pay for crimes that make our nation turn from God in shame. You've taken Satan's number. You've traded in your name. You've given government control to those who do you harm so they could burn down churches and seize the family farm and keep our country deep in debt. Put men of God in jail. Harass your fellow countrymen while corrupted courts prevail. Your public servants don't uphold the solemn oaths they've sworn. And your daughters visit doctors so their children won't be born. Your leaders send artillery and guns to foreign shores and send your sons to slaughter fighting other people's wars. Can you regain the freedoms for which we fought and died? Or don't you have the courage or the faith to stand with pride? And are there no more values for which you'll fight to save? Or do you wish your children to live in fear and be a slave? Oh, sons of the Republic, arise, take a stand. Defend the Constitution, the supreme law of the land. Preserve our great Republic and each God-given right. And pray to God to keep the torch of freedom burning bright. As I awoke, he'd vanished in the mist from whence he came. His words were true. We are not free, but we have ourselves to blame. For even now as tyrants trample each God-given right, we only watch and tremble, too afraid to stand and fight. If he stood by your bedside in a dream while you were asleep and wondered what remains of the freedoms he'd fought to keep, what would be your answer if he called out from the grave, "Is this still the land of the free and home of the brave?" God bless you, and God bless you.